Hello, I'm Jordan Farley, news editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Jane's not here this week because she's taking a well-deserved holiday, but today I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
And our contributing editor, Layla Latif.
Hello.
This week we're saying hell yes to Jordan Peele's Nope, sacre bleu to historical romance Eiffel, life is like a box of Golgoppers to Lal Singh Chadha, and we're asking where is Anne Frank? But first of all, what have you guys been watching?
Well, I can say what I haven't been watching that I wanted to watch, and I know you two will appreciate this, which is Bluey season 3 dropped today.
Yay!
I've been counting down the days. I think it must have not dropped till like 8 a.m. or something because it wasn't there before. I took my daughter to nursery today, so sadly had to make do with an old episode and just catch up, you know, next time basically. But I've been, yeah, been waiting for this day.
You've got more to look forward to when you get home episode. I love
it's
it.
So good. And it's so rewatchable. I don't think I've rewatched the show as much since like Arrested Development.
Matt and Layla, you both have children. I don't have children. And yet I still love it, despite the fact it is a children's show. It's just full of like great wisdom and life advice. It's so well made. It's so funny, so sweet. Yeah, I've watched the whole thing through at least twice. It's amazing.
It just packs so much into like 9 minutes as well. It's just funny, often moving, relatable. Like you say, wise. Just love it.
I always try and like steer my kids into stuff that I legitimately want to watch. So like I hate Peppa Pig and stuff, but I love Bluey. So I think it is like, okay, theoretically we're watching it for them, but it's very much me kind of standing over them being like, this is your favorite show.
What about you, Layla? What have you been watching?
I've been watching The Resort, which is another really good show that is out on Peacock. It seems to be going a bit under the radar, which is a shame because it's absolutely brilliant. It's got a wonderful cast. It's Kristen Milotti, William Jackson Harper, Nick Offerman, and it's all about a woman and her husband who come to like a tropical resort in Mexico, and they're clearly unhappy, but then they find an old mobile phone of a young guy who went missing like 15 years beforehand. So then the show is them trying to like piece together what happened to this disappeared guy. And I can't remember the actor's name, but he's just like that incredibly charming guy who's in like Booksmart and then has a small role in Licorice Pizza. Do you know this guy?
So I've been watching The Resort as well. It's Skylar Redondo. I don't know exactly how to pronounce his name, but yeah, he pops up in a lot of things. He's also in The Righteous Gemstones. He's good fun in that as well.
He's one of those people. I'm just always so happy to see him when he pops up in something.
But yeah, I'm enjoying the Resort as well. It's if you want to watch it in the UK, it's on now. It's kind of showing weekly at the moment, so the first four episodes are up there. But yeah, I highly recommend that show, actually. I agree completely.
I got to the end, and like it is nice that I kind of begged for them to send it to me because I got so addicted after the first couple of episodes. But like it goes so like highbrow sci-fi by the end. It's from the people behind Mr. Robot. But yeah, it's like fully Arrival by the final episode.
Wow. What? And Palm Springs as well, the creative team behind that. So you kind of know what to expect a little bit from that, I think. High concept. Well, speaking of streaming services, I recently added to my never-ending list of streaming subscriptions by getting a Paramount Plus sub. So I've been making my way through a few things on there. I watched the film Jerry and Marge Go Large, starring Bryan Cranston and Annette Bening, which is very sweet, very fun. It's about a kind of retired couple who game the lottery in their nearby state because they realize that if they take enough tickets, they're basically guaranteed to win a certain amount of money, and they let their neighbors and the local town that they live in on this secret, so everyone sort of benefits from it and they can rebuild their town a little bit. Very sweet, you know, didn't rock my world, but a lot of fun. And I also started Super Pumped, which I know you're a big fan of, Layla.
I love Super Pumped.
which I'm enjoying that as well, which if you don't know is about the rise and fall of Uber. Stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt as their unicorn CEO, Travis Kalanick.
Yeah, world's worst man, who's, you can just refer to.
I will say that I'm about halfway through it and I'm sort of losing interest a tiny bit, just because I feel like I watched this exact same show about 3 months ago and it was called We Crashed, which is a bit of a shame. I may have enjoyed this more if I hadn't already seen that. It also has, very oddly, Quentin Tarantino is the narrator of the show. And at the moment, I have no idea why, other than the fact that he's got a great voice, I guess. Yeah,
you've got a great episode coming up where it's all from the point of view of like the kind of very minor characters that you've seen so far, and they're all breaking the fourth wall. And I think that's when it really is its best, when it's kind of like not doing the We Crash kind of more conventional drama, and it's just like, we're just going to have Quentin Tarantino and some animation for no reason. One episode okay. That's just entirely in a meeting room. Yeah, no, keep stick with it.
All right, I need to get back on that then. I got slightly distracted by another Paramount Plus show called Players, which I don't know if you've heard of this. It's a kind of mockumentary about esports players from the team who did American Vandal, which I absolutely love that Netflix show. And I'm really enjoying it because it does the Spinal Tap thing where it's playing everything completely straight. Like, it's not winking at you. It's not breaking the fourth wall or anything. But the inherent ridiculousness of these people and the situation just makes you laugh constantly. Like, the main character is called Cream Cheese. And he's just like this complete douche. But that's just who these people are in this world. It's just very, very funny. Paramount Plus, maybe worth getting a sub to that because there's some good stuff on there.
I haven't
there.
Even heard of that last one.
Yeah, it seems to be going under the radar a little bit, but yeah, I'm really enjoying it. Well, moving on from what we've been watching at home to what we've been watching in the cinema. First of all, keep your eyes on the skies. It's this.
It's a bare miracle. They got a word for that.
Yeah.
Layla, do you want to tee up Nope for us?
I do. I love Jordan Peele so much. So I was very glad you're coming to me first. But yeah, so this film is his third feature, and it is about a pair of siblings called Emerald and OJ, whose father has very recently passed when a mysterious object drops from the sky and sadly embeds in his skull. They are then left to try and pick up the pieces of the ranch that was already on hard times. And it essentially is a ranch where they give horses to like commercials or films, or like they say, you know, they did the horses for the Scorpion King and stuff like that. They have a neighbor who is called Duke Park, who is a former child star that has now started this very strange little Wild West meets outer space theme park. And they're selling a lot of their horses to him because they can't really afford to keep it going. Then they spot that there is something very mysterious in the sky, some sort of UFO and kind of possibly proof of alien life. So they team up with a young guy who works in a technology shop and a kind of famed cinematographer to try and get the footage of this so they can kind of sell it on to, I think the dream is Oprah, and kind of make their fortune and like revive the fortunes of the ranch.
I get the impression that you liked it. Did you like it, Matt?
I did like it a lot, yes. I was just saying to Layla before we actually started recording that it feels like a long time since I've seen it. And because it came out in the US a few weeks ago, and obviously all the reviews dropped, most of them glowing, I kind of almost had forgotten it hadn't come out over here yet. But luckily people now get to see it in the UK, and very much worth the wait, I'd say. Good idea to go in as relatively cold as you can. Even the second trailer really, I felt, gave a bit too much away. But even having seen that, there were still surprises in this film, a lot to sort of unpack. There were yeah, just exciting little things to discover along the way. And it was one of those films for me that was just like that rare film that is full of ideas and extremely interesting and loads to talk about, but also just ridiculously entertaining at the same time. So if you kind of just want a really entertaining sort of Saturday night movie, you've got that. But if you want something a bit deeper, you've got that as well. So I thought it really, really delivered.
The one thought I had coming out of it was that, you know, Jordan Peele's obviously made Get Out and Us at this point, films with a sort of very clear purpose, especially Get Out, a very clear sort of message, I would say. I wasn't entirely clear what the main message of Nope was supposed to be on first viewing, but thinking about it after, I kind of appreciated that he has quite a few targets in this film. He's not just telling you one thing about American society. He's going for the idea that, you know, we're addicted to spectacle, that even the extraordinary has been sort of commodified and monetized. He's going for a kind of message about the earth and not messing with nature and what happens when you tempt the elements like that. He's got kind of bigger ideas in mind this time, I think. So it's an even more ambitious film than his last two films, which I was slightly surprised by, because, you know, Us in itself and Get Out, a much smaller film, they're both very ambitious in what they're going for. What did you love about it so much, Layla?
God, I love so, so much about this. I'm a huge fan of Jaws, and it just felt like this was, I mean, there's a lot of Jaws overlap. There's a lot of references to it. I was amazed by his ability to still like fully surprise me. There were so many scenes in it, particularly one that I'm sure you know I refer to, about halfway through when a big incident happens. And it took me about 10 minutes to even appreciate what I'd seen. I won't talk even about the first scene, because that was also such an incredible surprise. And I love this thing that Jordan Peele does, where he almost always starts his film twice. You always kind of almost have like a kind of self-contained little vignette of like, which is just kind of puts you on the edge of your seat. And then we actually start in the action. It's kind of everything that I love about big blockbusters. I love early Spielberg, but I also just love spectacle. And, you know, the pursuit of it in this film kind of seemed to mirror what Jordan Peele is actually trying to do himself as well, like pushing the boundaries, kind of taking us down routes that we didn't see coming. Because even having seen the trailer about 47 million times when I was writing my little feature for Total Film, a lot of this I just didn't see coming. But then the fact that kind of it is also grounded in like just fantastic performances from Daniel Kaluuya, I think, full movie star making turn from Kiki Palmer, and the return of Michael Wincott, like who I've missed so much. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I can't wait to see it again, because I think it surprised me at so many different points that actually maybe knowing what's going to happen, I'm going to appreciate a load of little details. And I've been enjoying the internet and like all the kind of listicles about like, did you notice that like, you know, some of the stuff that's on sale at the theme park, you see what that refers back to in the first scene. And I'm just like, oh my God, it does perfectly. This isn't just like Reddit being crazy. Like Peele is put so much into this movie. I loved it.
That's what really stuck with me afterwards. It's a very thoughtful film. There's a lot going on. You can unpick things. You can discover things after the fact. There are things you'll piece together in your head. We're not going to go into any great detail about it, but there's this whole kind of flashback subplot involving one of the characters, which initially, as you're watching it, it doesn't really feel connected to what's going on in the main storyline. But afterwards, you kind of realize, oh, this is mirroring this, or this is echoing this, and this informs how certain characters act in certain moments and how other characters don't act this way because they haven't experienced these things in their past. So that was all really smart. But then at the same time, you also get just this incredible spectacle. Like the last 40 or so minutes of this film is just one extended, extraordinary set piece, which, you know, this was filmed with IMAX characters. It's been designed for IMAX. It's a proper big summer blockbuster with immense scale and scope. Really incredible elements, which I haven't seen done on screen this way before, even though the kind of areas that he's operating in are very familiar science fiction elements. He puts a twist on it, which I thought was really interesting, really, really unique, and just made it feel totally fresh and new, which I really loved that side of it, especially.
Yeah, if I had a minor quibble, this sort of flashback scene that's been obliquely referred to a couple of times, I absolutely loved that. And it was kind of my favorite, probably my favorite aspect of the whole film. But I didn't feel like it entirely fitted. I almost wanted it to fit in more with the rest of the film. And I wondered if it was just a great idea that Jordan Peele had, that he was just looking to use somewhere. And he thought, I'll deploy this here, because I wanted there to be a sort of stronger connection to that, perhaps, because I just thought it was just such an incredible sort of scene. Again, if I had another minor quibble, I didn't feel that all of the logic always added up in some ways when it comes to some of the rules that are established. But these are minimal complaints. Like it feels like the sort of film that you want to go with friends and be having like dinner or time to catch up afterwards, because it is just one of those films you just want to kind of talk about and unpack. And Jordan Peele sort of seemingly has just such an eye for like an image. And there's just a couple of images in this that really, really sort of stick with you.
It's a real shame we can't get into spoilers here, because I just want to get into everything with you too.
it's one of those things with Steven Yeun's character, without giving anything away, we only get to see like really like small peaks at him, and kind of we get to kind of see what motivates him. We get to see where he ends up and where he's kind of, you know, maybe been foolish. For me, that was such a well-structured little subplot, because, you know, I kind of got it. Like, you can kind of show the end result and then have the tiniest peaks in Steven Yeun's performance where perhaps, you know, he's maybe relaying something that happened to him, but he does so in such a kind of slightly unhinged way that you can kind of see like all of the stuff bubbling underneath the surface. And that's what kind of made me, in the hours and days and weeks and maybe even months after this film, keep going over it, because I'm still trying to piece it together. He doesn't tell us exactly what's going on, and it's so fun kind of speculating.
Yeah, the thing that I really appreciate is that Jordan Peele sort of trusts his audience have the intelligence to put those things together. He's not spelling a lot of things out. He just gives the pieces to you and allows you to put it together yourself, which ultimately is quite satisfying when you do sort of get it. The flip side of that is, though, do you think audiences en masse will get it? Do you think this is a bit potentially too challenging for some people who maybe just want to be told a fun sci-fi story on a Friday night over their bucket of popcorn? Do you think it's going to be a bit too cerebral in a way?
It's just entertaining enough on straightforward terms, I think. Like, and even as I was saying, wanting more of a connection with the sort of flashback scenes, they're just so good on their own as a kind of, if you treat them as a sort of standalone sort of short film or whatever. So, you know, there's enough to appreciate there without, you know, getting too bogged down in analyzing it as you go or whatever, you know, if you're not quite sure how it all fits together. But
yeah, I thought on a kind of just like basic lizard brain reaction before I even started thinking about it, I laughed, I hid in my jumper and I cried. So it's like, tick the boxes.
I was chuckling my way through a lot of scenes in this. I mean, the fact that it's called Nope is it sort of becomes a running joke through the film, where the characters will see something that they can't comprehend and they'll just go like, nope. it's just a very funny sort of reaction moment every single time. I saw this at the UK premiere the other week, and the audience absolutely loved it. They went wild for it, especially during that sort of final sequence.
I think audience will really like it, because I think as much as kind of we've gotten used to like a certain type of blockbuster that sort of, you know, is maybe kind of shying away from the scarier elements because they want us to get that PG rating or something. It's very Jaws, it's very Jurassic Park, and those films were like really scary and really exciting and funny as well. And, you know, people love them. And then they also hold up, or, you know, decades later.
Very Poltergeist as well, the films. The key line of dialogue, which you'll probably not miss. Okay, well, that's Nope, and that hits cinemas tomorrow. Next stop, La Tour Eiffel. Is this?
Bonsoir. Regarde-moi.
J'espérais ne jamais vous revoir.
Eiffel?
Oui, pardon.
Il pourrait y avoir des idées sur le sujet du concours?
Il faut voir plus libre, plus audacieux.
Une tour. 300 mètres. Entièrement en métal. Un défi à la gravité. Aux éléments. Cette tour, messieurs, c'est Paris. Son rayonnement. Sa place dans le monde. Pourquoi tu m'as pas tout dit?
Matt, do you want to set up Eiffel for us?
This is Eiffel, or Eiffel. I'll probably switch between the two as I'm talking about this. As you can guess, obviously, in some way, it's the story of the Eiffel Tower. And it's basically a story I didn't really know much about. It says in its kind of opening title card that it's like liberally inspired by a true story. So you kind of sense where they're going with it from there. And it's sort of obviously all set over a period of about 20 plus years towards the end of the 19th century. You have Gustave Eiffel, played by Romain Duris. And he's an engineer, basically, kind of known for bridges, things like that. And France is looking for this, you know, to build some kind of giant monument. And, you know, you can guess where things go from there.
Yeah, also, spoiler alert, the Eiffel Tower gets built.
But alongside that, sort of more than being about the building of the tower, really, or equally, it's this kind of romance between Gustave and Adrienne Borges, who's kind of, you know, this young woman he falls in love with when he sort of meets her early on. She's the daughter of a very wealthy person who lends him some building materials. Throughout the course of the film, we follow their relationship from this sort of 20 years earlier period to the present day. And it also kind of occasionally jumps forward a few years to when the Eiffel Tower is actually completed as well. So there is a bit of a choppy, changey sort of timeline going on here. And thankfully, Romain Duris has a beard in this sort of later element of the timeline, so you can kind of keep track of where you are, because they don't really do much else in the way of age makeup for the two of them. And I didn't mind this too much. I'm sure it will get very sort of mixed reactions, but in some ways I just prefer it when we just don't even, you know, try to bother with, you know, kind of unconvincing age makeup and just leave it to the audience's kind of imagination. But I can see some people getting a bit sort of peeved by it, but
I was slightly peeved, I'm perfectly honest. Because I mean, my main issue is you have this huge age gap between the two leads in this film. Romain Duris is 48 years old, and Emma Mackey, who plays Adrienne, of course, you will know her from Sex Education and Death on the Nile most recently, she is 26 years old. They're supposed to be playing characters who are of equivalent-ish age. They first meet when Adrienne is supposed to be around 18 and Gustave is supposed to be around his late 20s. And then in the later scenes, we're supposed to believe that Emma Mackey's playing a sort of 40-year-old, which is just completely unbelievable on every level. They just sort of tie her hair back and that's about it. They don't really do anything else to her. They don't even give her like a few wrinkles or anything. I found that
glasses
very
good. Or something.
No, absolutely nothing. They put her in like a bit of a dress, tie her hair back, and that's it. Job done. And we're sort of supposed to believe that they're around those ages, which I just found intensely distracting. And also the fact that this is sort of supposedly loosely based on a true story, but apparently there's no record of him having this romance with Adrienne. There's no record of this woman sort of inspiring him to create the Eiffel Tower. I thought of it sort of like a French Titanic, where you have this, you know, this huge historical event happening and you have this fictional romance in the middle of it all. But I just sort of didn't buy into the romance between Gustave and Adrienne in the same way that I did between Jack and Rose in Titanic. It's never as sweeping. It's never as, you know, romantic. The one thing that I did sort of appreciate it for was that they do a pretty good job of locating you in sort of 19th century France. Great production design, great set dressing, all that kind of stuff. And I thought that the performances were decent, even though I had issues with the age difference between the casting. I don't think they slipped up too far doing that, but I just thought this was a bit of a nothing film, to be honest.
I can't sort of strongly argue with that, but it was one of those films I just kind of, you know, when you just kind of go with it because you like the actors. Emma Mackey, I thought really, I love Sex Education, and I really thought she stood out against the more kind of seasoned cast in Death on the Nile as well, with, you know, with that real sort of movie star quality, which I think she had here as well. And I guess I'm just a bit of a sucker for like a sort of love story over time, you know. And as Jordan said, yeah, I like the production design. There's some nice moments where I presume this was like a modestly budgeted film, but there's some nice moments when you're in the building of like the lower levels of the Eiffel Tower, you know, the legs are going up. I thought that was done quite convincingly, you know, with obviously kind of digital help, but it really had that broad thing that some sort of historical biographical films kind of do, where there's just some really on the nose speechifying at times with the importance of this, you know, and you know, it feels very, very sort of simplistic in that way.
There's sort of two other elements that I quite enjoyed as well, because you do see a reasonable amount of the construction of the Eiffel Tower. There's a lot, as you say, Matt, of them sort of around the bases of the structure. And there's this very interesting element where you find out that Gustave has sort of invented the system where he can like raise and lower the entire structure basically by kind of popping out a cork and letting some sand out or like pumping some air back into it. And that kind of blew my mind a bit, that they were able to just adjust the whole Eiffel Tower essentially by a matter of centimeters and millimeters. I thought that was incredible. And I also enjoyed the sort of unintentional innuendo of it all, in the sense that, you know, he's building this giant phallic structure in honor of this woman, like a monument to this woman. And there are just a lot of lines that are just very funny as a result when you're just thinking on that puerile juvenile way. So yeah, if you like unintentional innuendo, then this is probably well worth seeking out.
I do like unintentional innuendo. That's good. Yeah. I'm always so impressed by people that can like fluently speak another language. So like at the beginning, I was just like, oh my goodness, you know, Emma Mackey can speak beautiful, fluent French. But then as it went on and I didn't fully buy the romance between them, I didn't think that there was that much kind of chemistry, that much of a spark. And like, I don't think it convincingly expressed why these two people were so like desperately in love with each other. Like she seems to just see him once and then it's just like, oh, that's it. I just ended up being just like, I actually would quite like to see a documentary and have more about the engineering feats involved.
Yeah. Well, apparently Gustav wasn't such a bleeding heart socialist in real life either, because in this day they paint him as like a man of the people who's, you know, looking after his workers. He wants to do it for the French workers and the people on the ground, but no, apparently he was just like a capitalist like everyone else.
In it for the cash.
Yeah, exactly. Great. So if there's nothing more to add.
No, it's a very medium film.
Yeah, I think medium probably just about sums it up. Perfectly fine. Just don't rush out to see it, probably. All right. Well, that's Eiffel. And that's out in cinemas tomorrow. All right, next up, we've got alternative line reading, which, if you don't know, if this is your first time listening, is where I take a well-ish known quote from a film, say it in a very distracting accent, and Layla and Matt will have to guess what it's from. I'm actually going to say this in honor of a film that's coming up, so it's one we haven't actually spoken about yet. Yeah. It's in honor of Lao Sing Chada, which is a remake of Forrest Gump. So, of course, I'm going to say it in Forrest Gump style.
Yes.
All right, brace yourself. The lad that burns twice as bright burns half as long. And you have burned so very, very brightly, Roy.
My first instinct was Watership Down, but there's no Roy in Watership Down.
I actually meant to not say the character name because it's quite a giveaway, but I couldn't stop once I started saying the line.
You got into character, method.
I had a sense of where it was, but then the Roy just threw
it. Oh, I'm glad I included it then. It's a very big scene in it. Not the most iconic quote from this film, but...
Roy. I don't know any films with a Roy in them.
It's not the biggest like movies. Like Nope's got somebody called Antlers Holst, which is the best character name I've ever heard. What film's got a Roy?
A small clue, this character's surname really makes the name. Like once you realize who it is.
Roy Batty?
Yep.
Blade Runner.
I should have
known from Jordan it would be
either
Blade Runner or The Thing.
Of course, or aliens. Which I've already done aliens though, so I can't do aliens again. But yeah, that is Tyrell talking to Roy Batty. Just before he gets his eyes gouged out, lovely. And that line sounds like this.
The light that burns twice as bright burns half as long, and you have burned so very, very brightly, Roy.
Okay, next up, it's time to run and run and run with this.
Bhaag, Lal, bhaag!
Ab kuch log vishwas nahi karte, par jindagi mein chamatkar honde hain ji. Haan. Mummy kehti thi ke हर एक दी अपनी तकदीर होंदी है के सारा कुछ लिखिया होंदा है मैंनू नहीं पता किथे लिखिया है सब किसने लिखिया है और क्यों लिखिया है जो लिखिया है
रूपा मेरे साथ ब्याह करेगी
तुम मुझे बहुत अच्छे लगते हो लाल लेकिन हमारा कुछ नहीं हो सकता.
Okay, Layla, do you want to tee this one up for us?
Lal Singh Chadha is essentially a Forrest Gump remake, which is now the action is taking place in India. Lal Singh Chadha is the name of the main character, and he is a young Sikh who very much, I mean, kind of identically with Forrest Gump, we kind of meet him at school where he's not doing very well. He, you know, I think a bit like Forrest Gump, it's not exactly explained what the issue is, but he's differently abled and, you know, struggles to kind of cope with like mainstream education, and as a result is sort of a bit of an outcast. And then it kind of follows the similar path of kind of going through different like important moments in India's history, and much like kind of, you know, Forrest Gump was there for, you know, and meeting John Lennon and being a significant part of the Million Dollar March, that's kind of transposed onto the big moments in Indian history. And, you know, and much like in the other film, he's also got a woman from his childhood that he's been in love with his entire life, but, you know, she kind of sees him in a very like paternal way. And yeah, I mean, it's Forrest Gump. I don't know what to tell you. We've all seen Forrest Gump.
It's a very faithful adaptation, isn't it? Because it's sort of directly adapted from Eric Roth's script, basically, by another Indian screenwriter. Actually, a screenwriter who was an actor and just wrote this script basically on spec and then handed it to Amir Khan, the actor, and said, do you want to make this? And then it took him like 10 years to say yes, basically, but they ended up making it. But yeah, it's extremely faithful. I mean, the difference is that the fact that it's in India and not, you don't have this Americana. You don't have the icons that you have in Forrest Gump. You don't have Elvis. You don't have JFK. You don't have Watergate, things like that. Instead, you have a cameo from a very famous Bollywood actor, which I won't spoil, which is a lot of fun. Instead of Vietnam, you have the Kargil War, which is, you know, not as cinematically as iconic as Vietnam is, but they do some quite interesting things with it. And they do make some quite interesting changes to a few of the characters, I thought. Rupa, who is this film's Jenny, instead of, you know, becoming addicted to drugs and falling that way, she wants to be rich, essentially. Like, she just wants a happy life. And she sort of falls in with this kind of gangster type fellow who also appears to finance movies or something. I wasn't entirely clear on that, but there are some small character changes there just to suit the sort of new location of it all. But I thought the most interesting change was to the kind of Lieutenant Dan equivalent in this film, who of course
I was going to ask if there was a Bubba in this film.
Yeah, there is a Bubba. I actually love the Bubba equivalent in this film, because he's from a family of underwear manufacturers. Underwear kind of,
he's very into the underwear manufacturer.
Yeah, he just talks about underwear all the time, and he's just very endearing and very funny. I absolutely loved him. But then with Lieutenant Dan, instead of it being a, you know, a superior who's very sort of dismissive of Forrest in the original, it's actually basically the commander of the opposing force who is fighting the war against Lal Singh Chadha and his fellow soldiers. And Lal rescues him, and this character, who goes on to be called Brother Muhammad, he is abandoned by his own country. He's kind of given a home in India, and he becomes friends with Lal. So you get this extra element where it's sort of about, you know, countries who were pitted against each other, people who were told they were enemies with each other. They can become friends, they can become lifelong allies, that you shouldn't be brainwashed by what the people in charge are telling you. But there are some interesting new wrinkles that they've actually added into this. But for the most part, Layla's absolutely right. It's just Forrest Gump, but in Hindi, essentially.
I don't know whether this is controversial, because I think that maybe the cultural tide has gone with me, but I don't like Forrest Gump. I think it's a bad film. So, and I didn't realize that this was Forrest Gump. And about 20 minutes in, I was like, oh no.
Well, you didn't know it was a Forrest Gump remake, no. I mean, the film opens with a feather dropping at his feet.
Is he on a bench as well?
He's not on a bench, actually. He's on a train. Okay. And instead of a box of chocolates, he has a box of Golgappas.
They do look delicious.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I could have eaten loads of those.
I sometimes like to go in knowing very little. If I kind of haven't absorbed something, I won't like go and seek it out before a screening. So at first I was like, this is ripping off Forrest Gump a bit. And then it's like, oh no, this is Forrest Gump. And yeah, it reminded me of something actually when I did a Mary Harron interview for Total Film Feature all about like missing films and film preservations. And something she said to me then has really stuck with me, where she said that like sometimes what people think is like really important and great at the time just turns out not to be. And I think Forrest Gump is a very good example of that, because it won so many awards and like it just had such incredible box office and was like such a giant hit. But if you go back to like 1994 and like the other films that came out this year, like there's stuff that is so much more like important and exciting. And it's really bizarre to think that like people went crazy for Forrest Gump in a year of like, I don't know, Speed and Serial Mom and The Crow and The Shawshank Redemption and Interview with a Vampire and, you know, Hoop Dreams and Clerks. And it was just like, oh, we were not focusing on the stuff that was actually, you know, important to like cinema.
Yeah, I feel a little
Pulp Fiction.
More. I think I feel a little more kindly towards Forrest Gump than you do, Layla. I don't think it's like a stone cold masterpiece or anything, but I think it's a perfectly fine film. And I think there are perfectly sort of valid reasons to remake it, because relocating it to another country does give you a lot of avenues to do different things. One of the things that I did actually really like in Lal Singh Chadha is, you know, you have the moment where Lal starts running for reasons, as he does in Forrest Gump. He just keeps going and going for months, years at a time. In Forrest Gump, I felt like you were just seeing, you know, dusty, barren plains a lot of the time and not that interesting scenery. But here you have the whole of India, and it's such a beautiful country, and he goes to Kerala and these places on the coast, and it's just this amazing scenery, and it's just basically an excuse to do this incredible kind of nature documentary of India for about 10 minutes while he's running around. And I thought that was really beautiful, and that really benefited from being able to see that on a huge screen. But yeah, for the most part, it was a bit of an odd exercise just kind of doing it basically beat for beat Forrest Gump. Like, if you've seen Forrest Gump, then you've effectively seen this. Like, you're not really getting a huge deal out of it that you didn't get from the original,
even down to the sort of ending and everything that happens with Jenny. Yep. Is that true?
Yeah, don't want to spoil anything. But if you've seen Forrest Gump, then yeah, you know what's coming at the end of this film. But they do a really good job of kind of tugging on your heartstrings. I was sort of welling up at a few points. It's very sort of moving, but I'm a big old softy, so maybe a more tough hard person wouldn't be affected by it.
Heart of stone. Where's our Priscilla Queen of the Desert remake set in India? That'd be fabulous. We could see all of the like the wonderful Indian landscapes that way with a load of drag queens in a van.
Well, it's not too late. Anime Khan could do that next, you know?
Maybe I'll write that on spec.
All right, well, that's Lal Singh Chadha, and that is also hitting cinemas tomorrow. It's a stacked week at the cinema this week. All right, finally, a dose of Dutch courage with this.
Up until a year ago, everyone was in love with me.
Everyone?
It was all so wonderful. Then everything changed.
We're leaving.
They told everyone we were to blame for all the world's problems.
This secret apartment is going to be our hiding place.
So this is Where Is Anne Frank? And this is an animated film, and it's by Ari Folman, who most famously did Waltz with Bashir, which was another sort of animation, but, you know, kind of very much aimed at grown-ups, very much dealing with extremely serious topics. And I have really vivid memories of seeing that at the cinema, because it, you know, kind of sort of was one of those films that opened my eyes a bit, I suppose, to what animation could be like. And here he's obviously taking on the story of Anne Frank, which pretty much everyone knows in some way. You may be more or less familiar with it, but you're bound to be familiar with the very basics at least. And it takes a sort of an unusual sort of magical realist approach to it, in that it's largely sort of told from the perspective of Kitty, who is the kind of imaginary friend that Anne addresses in her diary that she's writing from this space that she's confined to in hiding throughout kind of, you know, World War II in Amsterdam, where the persecution of the Jews is intensifying. So her and her family have kind of, you know, sought this hiding place, which is obviously now become this very famous museum piece almost that you can visit in Amsterdam, and it's a hugely popular tourist destination. we follow kind of Kitty as she effectively comes alive from the diary in the house in Amsterdam. And there's these kind of two sort of timelines of the story in a way where we see Kitty kind of, you know, going out in, I say, modern day Amsterdam. The film says it's set 1 year from now. And then also we see flashbacks to kind of Anne's experiences and Anne sort of, you know, talking to Kitty back in the 40s. And it sort of weaves those two together and sort of goes from there, really. And did you like this film, Layla?
I was really looking forward to it because I was I liked Waltz with Bashir, and then this I think premiered at Cannes last year, and I think that's you know normally a good sign of quality, though not always, because I know Jordan had to sit through the new Claire Denis, which was dreadful. Yeah, I was pretty disappointed with it, I have to say. I wonder whether, I think maybe what it was trying to do too much was to be appealing to children as well as adults. Mm. And as a result, was just seemed a little bit too lightweight in a way. It's such an awful story of what happened to Anne Frank. And obviously the film acknowledges that, like, how absolutely horrendous it was. But then it just seemed a bit kind of strange that there was a lot of jokes about kind of boy craziness, and there's even like a pretty lame Justin Bieber joke in there because he famously went to Anne Frank's, you know, the museum, and then wrote in the guest book, like, Anne Frank, if you were alive today, I hope you would have been a Belieber, which, you know, one of the many things, ridiculous things Justin Bieber has done. I think the animation is absolutely beautiful. Like, it almost feels like, I'd love them to like almost turn this into a picture book, because it, you know, they're so gorgeous, these images and the illustration. And I think, you know, they managed to, even though it's very stylized, it's very recognizably Anne Frank in the scenes that she's there. But yeah, mm-hmm. I just thought it was, given how like powerful Waltz with Bashir is, and like Anne Frank is like endured as an image, as a sort of like personification of like the horrors of the Holocaust, this beautiful young woman being caught up in such a terrible event. I don't think it really lived up to what it could have been.
Yeah, I liked it a little bit more than you. I mean, obviously, if it wasn't animated, I think it would have been really hard to pull off, because I think it allows you to kind of, you know, go into, treat it as more of a fantasy. And yeah, really liked the animation. And I suppose it's always going to divide people in that other divisive films on a similar sort of topic include like The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas and Jojo Rabbit. But I didn't think it shied away too much from, like, you know, obviously it is presented in a sort of child-friendly way, and it doesn't go into any, you know, it doesn't really go into the grim details, but I did still find it quite affecting. And you have the way that the kind of Nazis are presented as these kind of like 8-foot-tall, like specters almost. And I found that quite effective, kind of, again, giving you that sort of child's angle on the whole thing. But then I wasn't perhaps entirely convinced by the way it wrapped up. I also wasn't entirely convinced by the sort of parallel it draws with sort of modern day refugee experiences, where I totally see what they're getting at, and there's some kind of powerful end title cards, but I almost felt it was powerful enough on its own, really. You could draw your own conclusions, but again, I guess if we're seeing it as more of a sort of family film that's going to start those conversations, I can see why maybe it would sort of play better to a younger audience.
Mm. Interesting. So I think we're saying not entirely successful, but worth checking out, especially if you have young viewers watching with you.
I think it might prove very helpful if you wanted to have like a very difficult discussion with your kids about like a terrible thing that happened. And this is a sort of good way to ease into that, because I guess that's, I think, I suppose we should have these difficult convos with them so we can kind of raise them into being wonderful, worldly, ethical people.
It is an important conversation to keep having, and that's kind of the point the film sort of makes, really, about kind of keeping that memory alive and sort of how important it is. And that's what kind of, you know, Kitty's journey kind of involves. But yes, I can see it being divisive for sure.
If you want to check out Where Is Anne Frank, it's also in cinemas tomorrow. Right, that's it for reviews, believe it or not. Plenty to choose from. But guys, what are your films of the week?
It's got to be Nope for me. I'd be surprised if Nope's not in my top 10 of the year, actually, when the year ends.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's going to be in my top 10 too. I would actually, you know, obviously you kind of gather a load of people to contribute. I see it doing very well in the general total film poll, actually. Not but that any of us are doing any polls at the moment or are slightly traumatized by having recently done a poll.
We all did our Sight and Sound polls, which is a poll of critics and filmmakers, which is done once every decade and has been since, I think, 1952, maybe even earlier. But yeah, it was a vaguely traumatizing experience for us all because you can only choose 10 films, the 10 greatest films of all time. And who can possibly whittle down a list of all of cinema to 10 films, you know? It's Sisyphean task, you know? It's impossible.
I guess one of the interesting things will be to see what films make it on that have come out from the last 10 years. And I actually think Jordan Peele's Get Out might get a good ranking.
Got a chance, definitely. Layla, I assume Nope is your film of the week as well?
Nope is my film of the week, the month. I was honestly watching it, and as a Jaws loving Jordan Peele nerd who loves Daniel Kaluuya, I just felt like, have they created a treat just for me? Have they gone into like my psyche and been like, this is what Layla wants, just ticking off the boxes?
I mean, Nope is my film of the week as well, but I would say don't sleep on Viles Singh Chadha as well. I thought they did about as good a job as you could expect. All right, Matt and I will be back next week, but before we go, there's time for another listener question, chosen very strategically in honor of all of our films of the week. What are the film moments that made you say Nope?
God, I so remember being in the cinema taking my university boyfriend who did not like horror films to go and see The Descent. I love The Descent, but I'm very claustrophobic. So that was a lot of Nopes from me, but like almost from minute one. Like, and the only thing that I could do to kind of deal with the fact that like everything in this film I was just fully rejecting was that like I would never go into a cave. They could never get me. I could never be in a cave thing because I'd never go in the cave. And, you know, just like that. Yeah, that visceral, absolutely not Nope moments throughout.
So torture for both you and your university boyfriend.
Yeah, we broke up not long after.
Probably explains why.
I did caving and stuff like that when I was younger on school trips, but I just have no idea how I do it now, because absolutely no way you would get me down there now. Yeah, I'm always thrown by these questions, but literally the first instinctive thing that came to mind, based largely on the idea that obviously Prey has been doing the rounds on streaming and doing very well, but when I first saw Predator, like I was just a massive Arnie fan as a kid, you know, and so I watched it just far too young. Most of the way through, I was like, oh yeah, this is fine. But then when the Predator actually takes its kind of, you know, helmet mask thing off and, you know, you actually see the proper Predator face with the mandibles and everything, that's what I definitively remember thinking, like, I'm not into this anymore. And being very, very sort of freaked out in the way that you kind of only can be at that young, tender age.
Yeah, now sort of kids cosplay as the Predator. Yeah. It's been robbed of a bit of its terrifying Nope power, hasn't it, in recent years?
Yeah, for sure.
Although I think Prey did a pretty good job of redesigning the creature and making it look really gnarly again. I quite liked its horrifying new looking Prey.
Yeah, I'm excited to watch that. I've heard brilliant things, and apparently it's done incredibly well on Hulu. It's like their biggest movie ever.
It is, yeah, apparently so, whatever that means, because they keep the metrics from us. So who knows, it could have had 10 viewers for all we know. All my notes are basically from a very specific subset of a sort of jump scare where just a very freaky looking thing suddenly appears. So key canonical examples of this for me would be the tall man appearing in It Follows, absolutely terrifying. I noped out of that. The creature appearing at the end of Wreck, also absolutely terrifying. Toni Collette crawling around on the ceiling in Hereditary, absolutely terrifying, noped out of that. And the big daddy of this one for me, because of the age that I saw it at, was the alien in Signs that you see in the home video that suddenly appears. That was like sort of like the ultimate, like, nope, right, that's it, I'm done, I'm out of here, nope, see you later. That was, yeah, just horrifying.
That also ties well to Nope. Definitely certain Signs vibes, but Signs to me is a film that just hasn't really aged that well. Distinctly remember I saw it at the cinema and had exactly that reaction when it's the kind of the kids' party, is it? The camera is kind of panning around.
Video, yeah, I would say unlike Nope, it doesn't stick the landing, should we say?
No.
Well, yeah. So the final, almost dialogue-free 15 minutes or so at the end of Nope is friggin' spectacular.
Yeah, Signs was the...
That was the kind of peak of Signs, that moment, wasn't it? It kind of goes a bit downhill.
Exactly, yeah. The ending of Signs was, I think, the moment where I sort of, the love in with Shyamalan kind of started to go off the rails a tiny bit. Like, I thought he could do no wrong. And then the ending of Signs, I was like, oh, maybe he's not the next Spielberg, you know? But maybe Jordan Peele is the next Steven Spielberg. Who knows?
Maybe Steven Spielberg is the first Jordan Peele.
Exactly.
You know, he's still a young man. He's got a lot of movie-making years left in him to surpass even my very high expectations of him.
Yeah, certainly hope so. All right, well, that's all we have time for this week. So all that's left is to say goodbye. Say goodbye, Layla.
Bye.
Say goodbye, Matt.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Move, children. Vamanos.